Stephen Levitt takes the same statistics that others use to draw familiar and sensible-sounding conclusions and sees something else. That something else that Professor Levitt sees won him the Clark Medal in 2003, which honors American economists under 40, and has made him just about the most intensely watched economist of these times. Professor Levitt and writer Stephen J. Dubner have tried to encapsulate some of his fresh looks at familiar and obvious questions in the new book, Freakonomics, A Rogue Economist Explores the Hidden Side of Everything. Stephen Levitt teaches economics at the University of Chicago and joins us in our studios. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Scott.
What's more menacing to have in your household if you have children, a swimming pool or a gun?
A swimming pool is about 100 times more likely to kill your child than a gun. It's just a simple statistics. So as many guns as there are adults in this country, and yet more young children are dying from swimming pools than from guns.
What do you say to people who are concerned that some people will use a statistic like that to say, well, you should get a gun in your household and not a swimming pool?
Well, I've been trying to get my wife to allow me to have a gun for a long time. I actually like guns. I think guns taken well care of are not that dangerous.
There's not two things that a lot of people would look for any comparison. Do you mind if I ask what caused you to do that?
No, not at all. I did have a great tragedy in my life. It was the death of my son at the age of one, neither from a swimming pool nor from a gun, from meningitis. But we went to support groups of other people who lost children. And what struck me as I heard how many stories involved drowning was to simply pursue the statistics to try to understand it, and then, you know, to try to maybe make something good come out of the tragedy of the people who have lost children. You know, it was just something that naturally followed.
You say in this book that as an economist, you believe incentives is what impels us.
Sure.
Human behavior. And you tell a very interesting story about a daycare center in Tel Aviv, I believe.
There was a daycare center that had a problem with parents coming late to pick up their children. They decided to charge parents a nominal amount. It was something like $3 every time they came late. One might have expected the result would be that fewer parents would show up late. In fact, it was just the opposite. And I think the explanation is $3 became the price to buy off the guilt.
So many people have identified incentives as simply financial incentives. You think that moral incentives can sometimes be stronger.
Oh, absolutely. Moral incentives, we're worried about our own self-perception. I think there are social incentives as well. We care about what our friends and family think about us. And I think in a broader view of the world, that often is far more important than direct financial incentives.
Mm-hmm. How is any of this stuff economics?
Economics is not a subject matter. It's a worldview. I think that what I do, it's not economic subject matter, but really at heart is the thinking of an economist. The idea that there's no political correctness in economics, you ask hard questions and you follow the data where it leads you, and it's a view of the world where incentives matter, and people aren't good or bad, they just sometimes they're good and sometimes they're bad. It depends upon the circumstances you put them in.
Is it true, Professor Levitt, you've been offered jobs by both the Clinton administration and this Bush administration?
Bush administration did approach me to ask me if I wanted to be an advisor on crime.
Yeah.
And I told them, you better go back and look at the study I did on the link between abortion and crime. And if you're still interested, call me back. And I never did get that return phone call. Because John Donahue and myself, a professor of law at Yale, came to the conclusion that one of the single biggest factors explaining why crime fell in the 1990s was the legalization of abortion in the 1970s.
I'll stipulate for those people who have just caught us in the early part of the interview, you say stuff that makes people on the left angry, you say stuff that makes people on the right angry. When violent crime statistics began to go down, there were people who said it's because of more aggressive policing. There were people who said it's because of more stringent sentences and mandatory minimum sentences. And then there were people on the political left, in the Clinton administration, for example, who said, well, it's because of economic prosperity.
And I don't think anybody will argue with this fact. Unwanted children are at an increased risk for crime. And there's 50 years of social scientific research which suggests not having parents who love you and take care of you is just a terrible thing for a kid growing up. And I think it's intuitive, and the research is there to support it. The second piece of the theory is that after the introduction of legalized abortion, fewer unwanted children were born. And I think that's not a very contentious statement either, that after abortion became legal, the number of abortions performed in the U.S. went up from about 100,000 to over a million within a few years. So we estimate that about 30% of this legendary, of this unparalleled crime decline in the United States in the 1990s can be attributed back to the legalization of abortion about 20 years earlier.
Mm. You recognize that what, among many other things, concerns people about this conclusion is that unscrupulous people will use it as an argument to force sterilization programs or compulsory abortions on the whole idea that if we want to keep down crime, we have to nip it in the womb.
Right. So let me address it in two ways. The first response is really the guts of our paper is saying if you give women the right to choose, they seem to be pretty good at figuring out when they can raise a child in a good environment and when they can't. So I'm always a little shocked by the response of this sort of forced eugenics sterilization view of the world. But the flip side is the numbers we're talking about in terms of crime are absolutely trivial if you compare it to the broader debate on abortion. From a pro-life view of the world, if abortion is murder, then we have a million murders a year through abortion, okay? And the few thousand homicides that will be prevented, according to our analysis, are just nothing. They're, you know, a pebble in the ocean relative to the tragedy that is abortion. So my own view when we've done the study, and it hasn't changed, is that our study shouldn't change anybody's opinion about whether abortion should be legal, easily available or not. So it's really a study about crime, not about abortion.
I want to draw you out a bit about crime.
Okay.
If you could explain to us the economic reasons, for example, that street gangs became the commercial conduit for crack.
Yeah, so street gangs prior to crack, prior to 1985, they weren't viable economic ways of life. And then crack changed all that because crack was the first drug that really threw off enough revenue or profit in such a way that the gangs were positioned to make it a lifelong job. We found the incredible number of a 7% annual death rate for drug sellers in this Chicago gang. We also argue their wages, the street sellers, were making roughly minimum wage. So you might say, what, are these guys crazy? They're making minimum wage. They have a 7% a year death rate. Why are they standing on the street corner taking these risks? And the answer, I think, is for the same reasons that, you know, the homecoming queen from some small town goes and waits table in Hollywood, that the high school quarterback gets up at 5 in the morning to lift weights, because they're dreaming the big dream, that really the gang was one of the few ways to have upward mobility for these inner city kids. And the idea was the only way to get from the bottom to the top was to start by selling on the street corners. The street sellers, to their credit, as soon as they realized they were not moving up, they dropped out of the gang. They were very cognizant of the fact that the reason to be in the gang was to get to the top.
There's a famous story in economic circles about, was it your PhD interview? You were asked, what's the overall unifying theme in your work?
Yes, it was actually at the Harvard Society of Fellows when I was trying to gain entrance to this very exclusive academic club. And so in my interview, someone said to me, well, so what's your unifying theme? You know, I choked on my words. I didn't know what to say. So someone jumped in. I think it was a historian. And she said, well, I think your unifying theme is such and such. And I said, yeah, exactly. That's exactly what my unifying theme is. But then Amartya Sen said, no, I think your unifying theme is really something else. And I said, Amartya Sen, I think he's right. I think that's my unifying theme. And finally, Nozick jumped in. And Nozick had been an intellectual hero of mine, although I had never met him. And he said, Steve, how old are you? And I said, 26 or whatever age I was. And he said, look, he's 26. Does he really need to have a unifying theme? Maybe he can just go along and do whatever he wants, and whatever he decides to ask, it'll work. And I think, you know, it got me off the hook. And I resigned myself. I'm not going to be a big thinker. I'm a little thinker. The best I can do is to hope to find little interesting things that maybe people can talk about cocktail parties. But it's better than nothing is how I view it. So I think you got to take what you're given.
Stephen D. Levitt, along with Stephen J. Dubner, the authors of the new book, Freakonomics, A Rogue Economist Explores the Hidden Side of everything. Professor Levitt, thanks very much.
Thank you very much for having me.
And to read an excerpt from Stephen Levitt's book, you can come to our website, npr.org.